Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on NABAClub.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. I get asked, what's the secret of the success of the Monday night Blue Chip speaker meeting? And one of the secrets is the 7:30 early morning study group. When I get a... These people, they show up, they suit up and show up 7 days a week, 7:30 in the morning, and they read the literature, and they're all about the solution. They remember how bad it was, but they live the AA life. And one of the best examples, Sharon Jay, so glad she's coming to share her message. She doesn't carry the mess, she carries the message. Come on up, please.
Hey family, I'm Sharon. I am a grateful recovering alcoholic. And it's only by His grace and mercy that I stand up here and I'm sober today. And for that, I'm truly grateful. And I'd like to open up with this seven-step prayer. My Creator, I am now willing that You can have all of me, the good and the bad. I'm now willing that You remove every single defect of character that stands in the way of my usefulness to You and to my fellows. Grant me the strength as I now go out and do Your bidding. Amen. Today, I have a light in my eyes, a smile on my face, and a song of praise in my heart. And those things were never, ever there before. And it tells me in a chapter 5, how it works, that I'm supposed to share my story in a general way, what it used to be like, what happened, and what my life is like today. I won't start off telling you that I grew up in a dysfunctional family. I won't say that, because every family has their skeletons in the closet. And my family is no different. But I will tell you that I grew up in a household where I was loved. And I have to say that because my mom and my dad, I know now they did the best they could to raise me. And I realized when I came into fellowship at Alcoholics Anonymous how sick my parents really were. They were sick. And they were suffering from this disease of alcoholism, and yet they didn't even know. And they died from this disease. But I can tell you that I never knew a day when I was hungry and my mom didn't feed me. I remember I grew up in a neighborhood ghetto. It was the ghetto. And we didn't have a lot. And the house that I lived in was a shotgun house. You walk straight from the living room, straight on out the back. And I grew up in a neighborhood where there were bootlegger houses on every street corner. Someone was bootlegging. I also grew up in a neighborhood where hearing police sirens, the ambulance, fire trucks, hearing gunshots, or hearing somebody got stabbed, that was nothing new to us. You know, that was like everyday life. We had a lot of drinking, a lot of drugging in my neighborhood. But I never knew a day when my mom didn't feed me. And I remember sometimes we really didn't have a whole lot of food. But we would always have peanut butter and jelly. You know, my mom used to get this surplus called welfare surplus. and they would give you this welfare, big old can of welfare peanut butter, those big old yellow hump, you know, long blocks of cheese and a little Spam and stuff in a can, and man, that was some of the best stuff. And I remember that peanut butter and jelly and cheese sandwiches became my friend. And sometimes it was so rough. Me and my brother, we laugh at this now, but we would fix a sandwich and there was no meat in between the bread. I love mustard, and I would fix mustard sandwiches. And he loved mayo, the mayonnaise, and he would have a mayonnaise sandwich. And we would have a big old glass of sugar water. A lot of times we didn't have Kool-Aid or soda, but we get up a glass of water, put some sugar in that thing, and stir it around. That was the best meal we had. You know, I grew up grateful. I never knew a day when I was sick and my mom didn't take care of me. I remember I used to hate to get sick. Mama used to go up in that medicine cabinet, and she would pull out the castor oil. You know anything about castor oil? Bless my mama's heart. She would put the castor oil on the stove. She would put sugar in it and squeeze some fresh lemon in it and warm it up. She tried her best to make that castor oil taste good. And she would give it to me, and God, that was some nasty stuff. But it did the job. You know, it did the job. And I never knew a day when I was tired and I didn't have a nice warm bed to sleep in. I grew up in a household where I was loved. But there was a downside to that story as well, because my mom had 5 brothers and 4 sisters. There was 10 siblings. And out of the 5 sisters, my mom was the only one to drink the alcohol. And I remember this one particular day. Well, I'm going to back up a little bit. I remember whenever my mom would go somewhere, she would always take me with her. I always felt like I was my mom's protector. I had to be there to watch after her. And we would go to the bootlegger's house. And the little children, we would be in that middle room. And they did all the drinking and the partying back in the kitchen. And they had the door closed. Well, I got to tell you that I've always had this curious mind. And you know what they said about curiosity, right? It killed the cat. And we were supposed to be in there, me and the children, other girls, supposed to be in there playing games. They were playing Monopoly and Sorry and cards and all this stuff. But I was the one peeping through the crack, you know, the crack of the door. Because I wanted to see what was all the noise and the laughing and the music. And I remember this particular time, I was peeping through the crack hole. And my mom, she would lick the back of her hand and sprinkle some salt back there. And back then, they used to have the 50-cent baby food shot glasses. And they would pour the liquor in a little 50-cent shot glass. And I watched my mom chug that liquor down. And then she would lick the salt on the back of her hand. And I remember the expression on her face, that woo, that frown. I'm like, whoa. I'm like, that thing, like, that stuff really tastes nasty. But then after another drink, everybody get loud and music and everybody having a good time. Well, this one particular day I was sick. I mean, I was sick and I couldn't go to school. I'll never forget this. I was in the 6th grade. I was about 11 and a half. I wasn't quite 12 years old. And I was sick and I couldn't go to school. My mom, she was the head cook at Jordan High School back in Columbus, Georgia. She was the head chef there. And she left me over to a bootlegger house to watch me while she went to work. Well, the bootlegger, Miss Stella, she had to go to take her son to school. And she asked me, she said, Sharon, you going to be okay while I take Chris to school? And I said, yes, ma'am, I'm going to be okay. And I waited till Miss Stella got around the corner and she was out of sight. I locked up the house. I went in the kitchen. went in the liquor stash, and I did the same thing I saw my mama do. I licked the back of my hand. I sprinkled the salt. Got that 50-cent shot baby food glass and poured me some red liquor in it and chuckled that stuff down and licked that salt. Woo-woo! That was some of the nastiest stuff I ever tasted in my life. And I said, well, if the red liquor tastes that bad, I wonder what the white liquor tastes like. So I did the same thing with the white liquor, and it didn't taste no more, too much more better. And I remember going in the refrigerator drinking beer, but I knew I had to drink this stuff fast because I knew Miss Fella was going to be back home soon. Well, people, the next thing I know, I was coming to at the medical center. I had a pretty bad case of alcohol poisoning. And they called my mama from work and told my mom that when she got there, I had a big old gash on my head where I had fallen and bust my head open, and I was vomiting, and she called 911, and they dealt with me, put fluids or whatever they did. But my mom got in a pretty bit of trouble about that because they want to know how 11-and-a-half-year-old girl get drunk, you know, get it in that condition, and she had a lot of red tape. But that was my first experience with alcohol. And I told my mom, I said, Mom, I'm never, ever going to do it again. And I didn't do it again until I was 14 years old. 14 years old, I discovered cherry wine. Cherry wine. I said, well, maybe I just drank the wine and not do the liquor because the liquor just didn't taste right. So I did cherry wine, which eventually led me back to the liquor, which eventually led me to the other stuff that we don't talk about in here. And I was on that journey. Truly, I was on that journey for a long time. And I remember leaving out my mom's house at the age of 17. I got married at the age of 17. And I remember I married my husband on a Monday. And I was giving birth to our first son on a Thursday. 4 days apart from marrying him, I gave birth to our oldest son. And God knows, I put that man through a whole lot of heartache and pain. Because all he wanted was to have a beautiful family with me and be happy. But alcohol had already taken control of my life. And I chose alcohol over my husband and my children. And there were times when my husband wouldn't see me for 3 days at a time. I would be gone for 3 days drinking and drugging. 3 days drinking and drugging. I remember staying in houses that wasn't even fit for a rat to live in. I had a home. I had a husband. I had children. But yet, my disease was more important than my family, my children. And I would be in that house drinking and drugging for 3 straight days without eating. Then I would come home and my husband would welcome me back in. I remember being at home, trying to stay at home, trying not to go out every weekend. So I try to stay at the house. But then I would run out of liquor because I would drink it as fast as I would buy it. And I remember running out of liquor many times, but this couple of times I ran out of liquor, and this particular time it was raining real hard outside. And I went to get in my car so I can go buy some more liquor. But before I did that, my husband took the keys from me. And he hit him, and he said, you're not going anywhere. It's raining out here. You drunk. You don't need any more liquor. Why did he do that? Because anybody that stood in the way between me and that first drink, it was on. You know, when I drank alcohol, I became that Incredible Hulk, that person that you wouldn't even recognize. I became angry, full of violence and rage and hate. He took those keys away from me, and I jumped on him. I jumped on him. I abused him. But yet, I called 911, and I told the police that he had abused me because I wanted to get my alcohol. That's how bad I wanted my alcohol. And when the cops came there, I told the cops that he had beat me. And the cops took him off and arrested him. As soon as the cops took him off and hauled him off to jail, guess what I did? I would get in my car and go to the liquor store because that's what I wanted. That drink was more important than he were. And I did that a couple times. I had him arrested for something he didn't even do. I had him going to anger management. They had him going to anger management classes. And this man didn't have no anger issue. I had the anger issue. But yet, and I had him charged for domestic violence. All this right now. Right now, my husband cannot purchase a firearm because he have a domestic charge on his record. You know? That's the wreckage that this disease have caused me. And I remember asking my husband, I said, after all that I have done to you, why did you stay? I would have left me a long time ago. I would not have stayed. He told me, he said, I love you. And I wasn't going to give up on you. And I wasn't going to let you give up on you. Well, if God's will, June the 10th of this year, of God's will, we will have been married for 31 years. 31 years. And it's nothing that I did. It's nothing that I did. You know, God instilled in him that love in his heart for me. I remember that man would get in the car and he would ride around the neighborhood looking for me. He would ask people, have you seen my wife? I remember when I got sober, my daughter, I only have one daughter and two sons, but my daughter would tell me, she said, Mom, she says, I used to be so embarrassed. She said, my dad had to take me over to the next door neighbor's house so that she could do my hair so I can go to school because you wasn't there. Wow, that was like a knife in my heart. You know, that was a knife in my heart. I wasn't there. Somebody else had to be a mother to my daughter. And on November the 11th, 2000, I had had enough pain. I had enough pain. I was invited to a birthday party. And I had been drinking all that day. And I think it was like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, I was heading back home, me and another guy friend. I have a husband at home, but I'm with the guy friend. And me and my guy friend, we head on back. And everything was a blur. Only thing I could remember is being real scared when I came to that morning, because I used to come to a lot. I had so many blackouts. Didn't know how I got home or how my car got home. And I remember I came to that morning, and that was a morning that was a day I will never ever forget, because when I came to and I was shaking. And I wasn't shaking so much that I needed another drink, which I'm sure I needed another drink, but it was fear. I was scared. I was horrified. And I thought I had dreamed some bad nightmare. And I didn't know what had happened to me, but I know something horrific, something happened to me. But I just couldn't remember it. I couldn't put the pieces together. I looked outside and my car was there. Didn't know how my car got there, how I got back home. I called my guy friend that I was with, and the guy friend hung up the phone in my face. I'm like, whoa, this must be bad. He hung up the phone in my face. So I called back again. He hung up the phone again. So now I'm still hungover, can't barely see a walk, but I get in this car and I drive over there. I drive over and I'm like, what's going on? Why you hang up the phone in my face? He said, you don't remember? No, I don't remember. He said, you almost got me killed and you almost got yourself killed. He said, that night when we left that party, you almost ran a man. Matter of fact, I ran a man off of the road. And the man got out of his car and he pulled a gun on me and my friend. And the only thing that saved us that night was his girlfriend. His girlfriend got out of the car and said, baby, leave her alone because you've been drinking. It's obvious she's been drinking and y'all don't want the cops involved in this. That was the only thing that saved us, because my friend said he had pointed a gun to his head, and he was pointing at me. He was going to kill us. And when my friend told me that, I said, I had enough. I've had enough. I called one of my cousins that I knew that was in this fellowship, and I called Homer T, and I said, Homer, I think I might have a problem with alcohol. He said, well, cuz, he said, if you think you have a problem with alcohol, he said, I'm going to an AA meeting tonight at 8 o'clock. And he said, how soon can you get here to my house? And I said, I'm going to get there as soon as I can. I think I was there in 10 minutes. And he opened the door and said, wow, you got here fast. I said, I'm ready. I said, I've had enough. I need help. And he took me to my very first AA meeting. So I'm not going to stay in the ism part of my disease, because that ism part of my disease is where I were, but it's not where I am today. But he brought me to my very first AA meeting. And it was on a Sunday night at 8 o'clock. I never forget. I came into that meeting, and I didn't know anybody. I knew my cousin Homer, but I didn't know anyone else. And I remember people was embracing me, wanting to hug me, and I'm here pushing people away. No, 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 don't touch me. Don't get too close to me. But the more I pushed away, the more they came and embraced me. They told me to keep coming back. Don't leave before the miracle. And I remember saying to myself, am I in the right place? These people just too friendly. And I heard laughter. And I saw all these smiles. And everybody was so friendly. And I'm saying, I don't think I'm in the right place. But I stayed there at that very first meeting. And a man named Marvin Crowell, may his soul be at rest. Marvin has shared a part of his story, and he shared how when he was drinking alcohol, he would call his wife all these verbal, you know, names, and how one particular morning he bust down the door and he sat at his breakfast table, and he could see those scary eyes from his children looking back at him. And he shared how even though he saw the fear in his children's eyes, the fear in his wife's eyes, and a busted down door where he had bust into the door, he shared that that still wasn't enough. That still wasn't enough to make him stop drinking. I could relate to that, because the same identical thing just about happened to me. I had been drinking, and bless my husband, how he always tried to control my drinking, but little did he know that alcohol was always controlling me. And so he tried to stop me from drinking once again, and my husband, he loved to play golf. You know, he's a golf player, and he keeps his caddy with all his golf sticks there, right there in the corner by the door. And he tried to stop me from drinking this particular day. I went and grabbed me one of those golf sticks, and this is a true story. I got that golf stick, and I swung it, and it came within inches within hitting him in his head. And a big hole in my front door. I had a big hole in the front door where he ducked, and the golf stick bust a hole in that door. And I remember the morning after trying to go in the kitchen all hungover, trying to fix breakfast for the children and the husband, sitting at the breakfast table, and my kids had this look in their eyes like, who are you? And where's my mom? And I saw this, but that wasn't enough to make me stop drinking. And I heard Marvin when he shared that story, and I'm like, wow. And then they were saying, listen out for the similarities and not the differences. And I heard a whole lot of similarities at that very first meeting. And I kept coming back. And a beautiful part about my recovery, I wasn't court appointed to come in here. The court didn't appoint me. My job didn't appoint me to come. I wasn't trying to save a marriage, because at that point, I didn't care if I had a marriage or not. But I came in because I had had enough pain. And divine intervention, God did for me what I was unable to do for myself. And that very first meeting, it changed my life. They told me to keep coming back. And I did. I kept coming back night after night after night. I kept coming back. In the first 3 months, I didn't say anything. I would sit there and I would listen. And they told me a whole lot of stuff. Go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I know a lot of people don't like to hear go to 90 meetings in 90 days because the newcomer focus so much on those 90 days that they don't really put the quality into their recovery. But they told me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and I did that. They told me to get with a woman, a sponsor, someone that had a working knowledge of the program, and I did that. I was very teachable. And that was another thing they told me, because always remain teachable. Because if I get to the point where I think I know everything, then I'm heading for another drunk. So they gave me all these suggestions. They told me, get a big book. I got a big book. My cousin, matter of fact, my cousin, he gave me my very first big book. And he didn't realize that when he gave it to me, one thing alcohol didn't take from me, and that was my love for reading. I love to read. And when my cousin gave me that big book, I left that very first meeting that night, and I went home. And I read that big book. I opened it up, read the introductions, the foreword. And then I got to the doctor's opinion. And when I got to the doctor's opinion, that chapter blew my mind. That chapter blew my mind. It was talking about that mental obsession of the mind and the physical allergy of the body. And it was talking about that allergy. And I could relate to being allergic to a whole lot of different things. I don't know how many of y'all listen to Joe and Charlie, but I listen to Joe and Charlie. I have the CDs. I have the book. I love Joe and Charlie. Well, Joe and Charlie break down that allergy, and they relate it to like a strawberry. You have people that are allergic to strawberries. They can't eat strawberries. I have a girlfriend. She's allergic to tomato sauce. She can't eat anything with tomatoes in it. Another guy that I know from AA, he's allergic to bee stings. If he gets stung by a bee, he got to have a little EpiPen, you know, right away, or he swell up and he'll suffocate and die. My daughter, she's allergic to shellfish. So a lot of people have an allergy to a lot of things. I have an allergy to alcohol. And if I put the first drink into my body, it sets off this strange reaction they call a phenomenal craving. And it's going to make me want more and more and more. I'm powerless over the first drink. Once I put the first drink in my body, I'm done. And I know that I'm done. My track history proves that I'm done. That I'm going to go back to the very first DUI that I had. I remember I had been drinking the whole day, which I always did drink the whole day. And I had just bought this 1995 red Dodge Neon. And I was riding in that car. Every time I drove, I used to have my best friend sitting right here beside me. He'd be sitting right there on the chair. I never drove without my best friend, alcohol. And I had been drinking, and I'm here driving down Macon Road. No, I was driving down Winning Road, where the old Olympic Health Spa used to be back in Columbus, Georgia. I'm coming down Winning Road. I'm coming down Macon Road. And I'm seeing the blue lights flashing in a rearview mirror. Well, my alcoholic mind tells me there's no way he's going to catch me. Yeah. And at that time, I was watching the Dukes of Hazzard. Just the good old boys. Never meaning no harm. Been in trouble with the law since the day they were born. I became the Dukes of Hazzard that night. And those police chased me from Winning Road to Macon Road to Box Road to Woodland Avenue to Holland Avenue where I stayed. And my alcoholic mind told me, it started off with one cop, but by the time I got on my street, it was like two more cops. It was three cops of police chasing me. well, Holland Avenue are dirt roads, and that's still a dirt road. We still have dirt roads in Columbus, Georgia, and Holland Avenue is still dirt road because it's a private owned property there, and those roads were never paved. Well, anyway, I get in my driveway, and my alcoholic mind tell me, I'm home now. They can't do nothing to me. Well, as soon as I open up the car, though, the cop right there, he right there, and he gets me, and he cuffs me, and one of the cops, he knew my husband because he went to school with my husband, and he told my husband, he said, man, your wife is the luckiest woman I've seen. When I turned on Box Road from Macon Road, there's a big old meteor there in the road. I turned that corner so fast, I had that car leaning over like this on two wheels. And he told my husband, I don't see how in the world she survived that. But he said, man, because I know you, I won't charge her for reckless driving, because I was supposed to got a reckless driving charge. But all I got was the DUI charge, but that was enough. The DUI charge was enough. Well, it didn't stop there, because you heard me tell you that when I drank alcohol, I had full of anger, rage, and I was very violent. They take me down to the police station to book me. This female cop, she fingerprints me, and she's pulling and snatching. I didn't like the way she was pulling and snatching. I grabbed my hand from her hand, I balled up my fist, and I hit her so hard. I hit her so hard, she fell down, and two more cops came, and it really took three cops to contain me. I was fighting with three cops, but you know that song that say, I fought the law, but the law won? The law won, because I ended up getting thrown in a hole. And I stayed in the hole until my husband, once again, that old sweet husband of mine, he comes and bailed me out. Now, to show you how sweet he is, he got someone to watch our children, because he didn't want our children to see me in that state. So when he posted my bail, we went to a hotel. He took me to a hotel where we stayed in a hotel that night until I sobered up and got my head right, and he took me home. Those were the things that he did for me. And I'm here telling you, when I came in, I got a sponsor. And God always direct me to the right people in my life. The right people. He guided me to the perfect woman. And I'm here to tell you that I didn't like women, because I didn't trust women, because I didn't trust me. I didn't trust me. And I didn't trust my species. But I love men. But I just couldn't stand the women. But see, God guided me to the perfect woman. And it was through her I built up a trust. I built up a friendship. And I never forget, if I didn't call her, she would call me. She said, Sharon, she said, I want you to come over here. See, the AA I grew up in was hardcore AA. They didn't ask you to do anything. They told you, this is what you're going to do. They didn't care if they hurt your feelings. They weren't trying to hold your hand and wipe your snotty nose. They told you, this is what I want you to do. And you did it. And she would call me. She said, Sharon, I want you to come over here so we can get started with your step work. I said, okay, I'm on my way. I would go over to her house. We would eat ice cream, play dominoes. And then we would go back there in her bedroom, and we would do some step study. And we did that for days after days after days. We would go in her bedroom and do step work. And I remember when I was doing the step work, I cried so much, so many tears were just rolling down my face. I'm like, where are these tears coming from? Because when I was drinking alcohol, I couldn't shed one tear. But I'm crying, and my sponsor said, it's okay, because the tears are cleansing your soul, and you're healing. And I discovered through working the steps with my sponsor and through coming to the fellowship, I realized some wonderful things about me. I realized that I wasn't a bad person as I thought I was a bad, bad person. I shared one particular day of all the bad stuff that I had did. I went on and said, I did this, I'm a bad person, and da-da-da. Mr. Kelly, may his soul be at rest, he came behind me and he said, Sharon, he said, I don't know what big book you reading, because the big book I read don't say that we're bad people. It said that we're sick people suffer from the disease of alcoholism. And I'm like, wow, I'm sick. I'm sick. Now what do I do about it? And that's where the steps came into play. The steps helped me to cleanse myself from the inside out. And there was a whole lot of wonderful things and scary things that I discovered about me. And it was hard working on me. I don't want to admit that I was selfish and self-centered and had that egotistical thinking. And I didn't want to admit that I was full of anger and rage. But I had to be honest, because they told me that I would be as sick as the secrets that I kept. And that unless I was completely, thoroughly honest with myself about what this disease had done for me, that I would not have a chance at recovery. So I had to keep it real. And I had to be honest with myself. Alcohol had whipped my behind. And I remember on page 8, and as Bill sees it, Bill gives a beautiful, he gives a beautiful example of his step 1 when he talks about no words could explain that loneliness and that bitter morass of unhappiness that he had had. He said that quicksand had stretched around him in all directions, how he had became overwhelmed, how alcohol had became his master. And I'm like, wow, alcohol had became my master, and I was sinking quick and fast and hard. But it was God's grace and mercy that saved me. And I remember when I was out there and it isn't part of my disease, my sister and my niece had came to visit with me. And after they left, I watched them as they drove away. And I remember looking up at the heavens, and I remember just screaming out so loud, God, please let me not go so far astray that I can't find my way back to you. And it took me 18 years, but God guided me into the rooms, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he put some beautiful, wonderful people in my life that helped me on this journey. And I know that I could not have done this alone. And step 1 is that this is a we program. I got drunk. We get sober. We stay sober. We help each other to stay sober by sharing our experiences, our strength, and our hope. That's how it works for me. I cannot do this alone. I could not stop drinking on my own. I came inside these walls, and I became teachable. I became teachable. You all became that power that was greater than me. I knew that there was a God, but I didn't have the right relationship with God. I had that love-hate relationship with God. I loved him, but yet I hate him. I blamed God for everything that had happened to me in my life. So I played the blame game a lot. But it was through the steps I learned how to take the blame out of my vocabulary and put the responsibility on me. I learned how to put the responsibility on me. And that's what I did. I learned how to become responsible for my own recovery. I learned how to do that. And people, God has been good to me. I have been through a lot in sobriety. I had, in 2005, I had been diagnosed with cancer. I'd gone on my chemo treatment, and I overcame the cancer. Only by his grace and his mercy, cancer didn't defeat me. With God's help, I defeated the cancer in 2005. And I was in treatment for a few years before I was totally had regained my strength because I was so weak and so sick all the time. And there was times that I thought that I just wasn't going to make it, but I didn't give up. I became that little red engine that could. I held on in there. I had a baby boy, my youngest son. When he was 18 years old, he got sentenced to 5 years in prison. This boy was my helper. Anything I would ask him to do, he would do it. And he got sentenced for 5 years in prison. But I didn't find it necessary to take a drink of liquor. And then a couple years after that, my oldest son, he was sentenced to 2 years in prison. But I didn't find it necessary to take a drink over that. I've gone in and out the hospital for health problems. I suffer from asthma, and sometimes I can have some very bad, you know, bouts of asthma. But I've overcome and I deal with that on a day-to-day basis. I also deal with depression. I don't suffer from depression. I deal with depression. I cope with depression. I manage my depression. And I don't let it manage me. And no matter what I have ever gone through in this fellowship, there was nothing that was going to make me take a drink. Someone told me, they said, Sharon, the only thing that will make you take a drink is that right hand. So I couldn't use excuses. Excuses weren't going to cause me to take that drink. Only if I pick it up and put it to my mouth. On November the 19th, 2006, Almighty God took an angel away from the earth and up to the heavens with him. My mom, she passed away in 06. My mom was the love of my life, and I didn't find it necessary to take a drink. When I was 10 years old, before I even came into the program, My father, he was a smoker and he was a drinker, drink alcohol all the time. And he had went to sleep with a cigarette and he burnt himself up. And by the time they found him and got the file, his body was so badly burned that he couldn't be saved. I had to go through psychiatrists. God, I went through so many psychiatrists. I wanted to commit suicide. I wanted to kill myself. But I survived through all of that. And when I got sober, that was still haunting me. That was still haunting me. And even today, when I think about my father and what happened to him, sometimes it puts a warm spot in my heart because I miss him. And I know that if he would have known about Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have hoped that he could have found his way. And then my mom, she was one of those people, she drank alcohol, but my mama was one of those people, she would get her vodka and she would mix it with orange juice and she would sip on her drink. And I will swear it took a whole hour to just finish that one drink. But see, my mom was a diabetic. And insulin and alcohol don't mix. Type 1 diabetes, my mama was taking her insulin and she was drinking her vodka and orange juice. Mama had a coma. She experienced a stroke from that. She lived for 3 months and she passed away. And that was in 06. I didn't find it necessary to take a drink. No matter what I've been through, if God can bring me to it, then I know that he'll see me through it. And there's nothing that my God can't do for me today. Nothing that my God can't do for me today. And I'm going to read this, and I'm going to get ready and close out, because I do believe in ending on time. But I want to share a couple of things before I close out. A guy by the name of Robert Griffin, we called him Bob. Bob, he's the love this poem, Footprints in the Sand. Footprints in the Sand. I used to wonder why he loved that poem so much. Every time he would give his story, at the end of his story, he would read this story from Footprints in the Sand. But I kept coming back and I realized why this poem was so important to him. And I'm going to share it tonight with everyone. footprints in the sand. One day, one night, a man had a dream. He dreamed that he was walking along the beach with the Lord. Across the sky flashed scenes from his life. For each scene, he noticed two sets of footprints in the sand, one belonging to him and the other to the Lord. When the last scene of his life flashed before him, he looked back at the footprints in the sand. He noticed that many times along the path of his life that there was only one set of footprints. He also noticed that it happened at the very lowest and the saddest times in his life. This really bothered him, and he questioned the Lord about it. He said, "Lord, you said that once I decided to follow you, you'll walk with me all the way. But I have noticed that during my most troublesome times in my life, there is only one set of footprints in the sand. I don't understand why, when I needed you most, you would leave me." And then the Lord replied, "My son, my precious child, I love you and I will never leave you. During the times of your trials and your suffering, when you see only one set of footprints in the sand, God, it was then that I carried you. God carried me. God carried me through all those times when I would be so drunk I had to close one eye just to keep on the right side of the white line. God carried me. And I know today that without my HP, without my high power in my life, my relationship, I found God through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was through those steps that I got in a relationship with God, the God as I understand him to be in my life. And it wasn't that get you God that I grew up with, that get you God that was going to damn me, my sins, to hell forever. But my God had to have certain attributes. I needed God's understanding. I needed God's mercy. I needed God's grace. I needed God's forgiveness. And most of all, I needed God's love. And I found those things in the God of my understanding through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one more last reading that I want to share before I leave, one that everyone should be familiar about, is acceptance. When I came in here, there was two things that I could not stand to hear. I didn't want to hear anything about gratitude, and I didn't want to hear anything about acceptance, because I had no gratitude, and I wasn't going to accept anything. But today, those are my favorite two topics. I love gratitude, and today I do have acceptance. Because I know today, acceptance don't equal agreement. I don't have to agree with you, but there's nothing I can do to change you. So I have to accept you. And I know that today. And acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. When I am disturbed, it's because I find some person, place, thing, or situation, some fact of my life that's unacceptable to me. And I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, thing, or situation being exactly the way it's supposed to be at that moment. Nothing, absolutely nothing, happens in God's world by mistake. Until I can accept my alcoholism, I could not stay sober. Until I can accept life on life terms, I cannot be happy. I need not to concentrate so much at what needs to be changed in the world as what needs to be changed in me and in my attitude. Shakespeare said that all the world's a stage and all the men are just merely player. So Shakespeare, he forgot to say that I was the chief critic. See, I was the one that knew. I could see every flaw in every person because I knew you wanted perfection just as I did. But it was AA and acceptance. They taught me that there's a bit of good in the worst of us, and there's a bit of bad in the best of us, that we're all God's children and we all have the right to be here. See, when I'm complaining about me or you or you or you or you, I'm complaining about God's handiwork. And I'm saying that I know better than God. If I knew better than God, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be here saying that I'm an alcoholic. So today, I know that I don't have to agree with it, but I do have to accept it. Because the only thing I can change are my own thoughts and my own behavior. So for the newcomer, keep coming back and don't leave before the miracle. Thanks for letting me share.
Sharon, my mother was my drinking buddy, and she was a diabetic. And another thing, she was born and raised in Columbus, Georgia. I went from third grade to eighth grade there. And when we left Columbus, they lost track of her. And 2 years before she died, the classmate committee at Jordan High School had her come down as guest of honor for her 50th class reunion. Just loved everything you said and shared, and I always felt very close to you, regardless of whether it was alcoholism or not. You're good people. Thanks, Sharon. And speaking of good people, we've got a new member of the board of directors with us, membership director, Noelle, and I'm going to ask Noelle to come up and give out the chips. I got them all lined up right here.
I'm Noelle. I'm an alcoholic.
They're right here.
Oh, thank you. We use chips to mark our time in sobriety. And Sharon, thank you so much for that story. I feel like I've been to church. I needed that. And I can relate. Anyone want a white chip? Anyone want to try this way of life for 24 hours? Excellent.
All we'll all be together on that broad highway.